Along with Tibetan Buddhism, the little-known Bon culture and religion was also threatened when the Chinese occupation forced its way into Tibet. The sentence, war, persecution, and the salvation of, could be the lead-in to many a story throughout history. But today's tale, as told in the book Flight of the Bon Monks, recounts how three monks were basically the thread that kept the Bon religion and culture, Tibet's oldest, from disappearing under the thumb of the Chinese. Authors Jackie Cole and Harvey Rice are with us today. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Generally, the world is aware of the Tibetan Buddhists, the people and their land, and the horrific treatment they had when the Chinese invaded, but not so much is known about the struggle of the Bonpos, the monks of the Bon religion, and their struggle to keep Bon alive. What compelled you to write their story?
I've been a student of the Bon tradition for about 20 years now. I began to hear stories about the fact that as we were all growing older, including our teachers, that there were only a few that had escaped from Tibet that were still alive, and that they had undergone terrible things. One of them was shot and spent time in a concentration camp and so forth prior to their escape. So I thought it would be important to have the story recorded before they passed on. And so Harvey and I talked about it and decided that it would be a fun project for us as well as an important project.
Was that your take too, Harvey?
Yeah, at that time I was working for the Houston Chronicle and I was in my home office, and Jackie just walked in one day and just said, "Harvey, listen, I just heard this fantastic story about some of my teachers and about how one was shot and left for dead." And she said, "Why don't we do a book about this? How do you feel about that?" After hearing the story, I said, "Let's do it." It sounded like a good story. And little did we know there was so much more to it that we discovered as we began researching and interviewing people.
Boy, I have no doubt about that, just the way history will unravel and connect. But also, speaking to your book, Flight of the Bon Monks, it's so in-depth and very, very well written, certainly. Someone in your book wrote of the Bon that it was a living, complex, and sophisticated spiritual and cultural tradition. And that made me think of the Ho'oponopono, which is the Hawaiian philosophical tradition that offers clarity for living a peaceful life. And Jackie, I'm wondering how you would characterize the Bon religion.
The Bon tradition was the original religion in Tibet prior to Buddhism coming in the 7th century. There's a book called The Nine Ways of Bon, which outlines the different kinds of practices that can occur within the tradition that can help you. So they become tools for being able to live your life and to heal if you're sick or there's illness coming through the village, or to help with the weather and for their crops, to help with staying connected with the earth and the spirits of the earth, as well as a training curriculum for your mind so that you can be at ease and peace and head towards learning your own true nature. If you can live in your own true nature, that's considered enlightenment.
Do you have a personal experience, not with the enlightenment piece, but that other piece that I've heard you say in a previous interview, that there's such an earth element, and you mentioned the healing or the rain or the weather. How have you interacted, or have you interacted with any of that?
There are practices with the five elements where you connect with them. It's pretty universal. For example, if you're trying to connect with the earth, when you want to sit with the earth and be with the earth and see the mountains and so forth, and then you actually almost become earth, or the water, and then you can use the elements and the characteristics of those elements to provide for you either strength or deficiencies, to ameliorate deficiencies that you may have in your body, because it's all interconnected.
Of course.
So, for example, if you are a little scattered, then you want to try to cultivate earth, which is stabilizing and grounding. On the other hand, if you are tight in and everything is in your too stable, if you're too earth ground, then you want to cultivate either space or fire so that you can get a little energy going and you can move on up. So, and then in the healing, I can attest to some of the healing, not necessarily in terms of healing myself, although on one of my trips I had altitude sickness. And we had gone to Colorado hiking sort of to test ourselves for altitude before we went to Tibet. And I got altitude sickness on this hike. And some of the practices that we were doing to try to acclimatize myself better were the earth-based practices to try to get grounded. I'm a retired veterinarian, and I know in my veterinary practice that there would be times when I had to perform a procedure on an animal, and I was nervous about it. I wasn't sure about the outcome. I was scared for the animal, scared for myself. So I would just evoke the energy of some of the healing protectors that I had learned about through this tradition. And we just take a pause, take a deep breath, maybe do a little bit of a mantra that is the vibrations would balance your body. And then things would just go very smoothly for me, fortunately. Mm-hmm. So those are some of my personal experiences with some of the practices that they talk about, that they teach us in the tradition.
And Harvey, I can only imagine that philosophically, you would be on board with Ubun, because it seems like it is a wonderful philosophy for living a peaceful life. Did you approach this more from an interest in history, or what grabbed you once you started rolling?
Well, I just thought it was a good story. It was an important piece of history. Jackie already knew these people, and I had met some of them, but as we got to interview them, the more I thought the world needs to know. I think it reflects on the current situations, the way that Chinese are treating the minorities. And when we went to Tibet, we could see the oppression. And we could see the military, the check stops, the police everywhere.
Yes, I was going to ask you later about this, but with that intimacy of your involvement in this story, is there one lesson that stands out to either of you within that realm of either religious persecution or overall human freedom?
I think that one moment that really came to me is we went to a Buddhist monastery that was still active. It was near Lhasa. And they had a plaque near the entrance, and it had the names of all the monks that were there, the name of the abbot, and then above that in the hierarchy was a communist official. So a communist official was over that monastery, and that I thought that was so emblematic of what is happening. And then in my research, I discovered that part of the Chinese policy is to control. They're not opposed to having Buddhist monasteries. In fact, they have been rebuilding them because they want the tourism, but they don't want any independent thinking going on in those monasteries, especially not any support for the Dalai Lama. And so, you know, they're controlling everything about Tibetan life. And because religion is so entwined in Tibetan life, it's in everything Tibetans do. And so by controlling that, they think they control the Tibetans. I don't think they've done a good job. The Tibetans, when we were there, they have clung to their religion and their ways. even though they're becoming a minority in their own country because the Chinese are just packing the country with Chinese immigrants as another way to suppress and obliterate that culture.
Yeah, certainly diffuse it.
And they consider monks as enemies of socialism.
Yeah. Maybe we
what
can...
I found, what I,
please.
What I found... Well, of course, I'm attached, although you're not supposed to be attached in this
lesson number two
with it, to anything. But I was so attached to my teachers that the story deepened my devotion and inspiration to them. But the thing that I found the most remarkable was how courageous they were, how they just kept moving one foot in front of the other. And connected with that was how was their devotion. Their devotion, of course, to Tibet, but to their and to their religion, but also it translated in being devoted to each other and the people that were around them. Just instance after instance after instance of this. They came out, they were separated on these flights, on these trips out, they got separated, they came back in, and the first thing they did was to go to find their buds and their buddies and their friends and their cohorts. And it didn't matter if they were 500 miles away, they were going to go connect with them and take care of them.
Yes.
So it's just a real lesson in the courage and the love that is possible.
In along the lines of what Jackie is saying, there's one incident. We went to the Jokong. The Jokong is the oldest Buddhist temple in Tibet, and it's in the Barkor. The Barkor is sort of like a street that runs. It runs in like a square around the Jokong, and the Barkor was a place famous for its merchants and things. So when we went there, to get into the Barkor, you had to go through a metal detector. And they took away anyone's matches. Anyone had matches or a lighter, they confiscated it because people had immolated themselves in protest against the Chinese government there in the Barkor. From there, we went to the Jokong, and there must have been, I don't know, 50 people in front of the Jokong doing prostrations. These are the faithful Buddhists, and these are people that many of them have walked miles and miles, some hundreds of miles, to get there for this pilgrimage. And the Chinese government doesn't encourage that, and so there were police there with clipboards, and they were walking among the pilgrims who were doing prostrations and looking at them and then writing things down, which it seemed to be a form of intimidation, but it also seemed to be a symbol of defiance that these people, they came there, did their prostrations, and showed their dedication to their religion despite all the police presence and all these people trying to intimidate them. We walked to the top of the Jokong. There's a building right across, and there were Chinese troops going through these exercises.
Calisthenics
on top of the roof. Our guide was with us, and they said, I started to take a photo of them, and she said, "Don't do that, because they'll be over here. You'll be in
bye-bye camera at the very least, right?
Yeah, so.
Yes.
But I did get a quick picture of that, which we do have.
Right. Now, I definitely don't want to focus on this, but what would you say your relationship was between the Bon and the Tibetan Buddhists? It seemed in your book that it went through periods of not so friendly.
Bon was the original religion, and then for political reasons in the 7th century, the ruler of Tibet decided that Buddhism would be a religion that would facilitate communication with people on the outside of the world and within and so forth. So they wanted to establish Buddhism as the dominant religion, as the court's religion. And so they banned Bon, and they told the Bon people that they could convert or they could move or they'd have to go in and relearn to Buddhism and so forth. So they banned Bun, and it was banned until the 11th century. And in that, during that period of time, of course, many tales were told about Bun, about how awful it was and black magic and all kinds of things. Mm. So in the 11th century, there began to be a revival of Bun. I mean, it's not so much as a revival, but it began to be allowed to be practiced again. So the Bun is a minority religion in Tibet, and the Chinese don't recognize Bun, the difference between Bun and Buddhism. Anybody there in a robe is bad, period. So there's no, it's not like they persecuted Bun any more than they persecuted the Buddhist, but it's just that they started out smaller. So when you start knocking everything out and you're smaller, then you get even more endangered.
Yeah.
If you didn't know the difference, if you didn't know the subtleties and the difference in the two religions between Bun and Buddhism, if you just look at a 5,000 or airplane view of it, then they look very, very similar. The iconography is similar, the colors, the practice, some of the practices are pretty similar. But there are some differences that separate the two. And the Bun, of course, that's history says that they've been around for 18,000 years. The Buddhists since Sakyamuni Buddha in India, and they came to Tibet in the 7th century. So depending on who you talk to, the Bun says that Tibetan Buddhism arose out of Bun, or was an amalgamation of Bun and the Buddhism that came from India. And the Buddhists say that the Bun, because they were suppressed for so long, by the time they came back into being in the 11th century, they had borrowed everything from Buddhism. So depending on who you talk to, well, both sides say the other side borrowed from the other. And there's a lot of scholarly stuff that's been going on to try to establish if there was indeed Bun that is like the Bun now, but prior to the 7th century.
Mm, I see. Well, Tenzin becomes the hero not only of Bun's survival and of your story as well. What do you think stretched his endurance most? Was it his faith or the physical difficulties?
And that's a good question. And I think knowing what we know, having interviewed him, and also hearing about his childhood, Bun, as well as Tibetan Buddhism, believe in reincarnation, and there may be something to the fact that he was so drawn to Bun from the very beginning, so drawn to the devotion. And when he was a child, having the monks around him come in and say, this kid is special, that they were able to see that kind of thing. So there may have been something innate in him that drew him to become a leader in the community. But once he was a leader, and he did take on leadership responsibility, he took that very seriously and knew that if, since he was a leader, that the community was dependent upon him, and he was going to move forward and fulfill that. That's part of the dedication, devotion, and courage that I was talking about. Had he not been an important leader to begin with, he was one of the highest recognized lamas in the tradition before the Chinese invasion. Had he not had that piece of leadership, then those roles of responsibility, he may not have taken up the cause, so to speak. Going to London allowed him to develop the qualities and to help to fulfill his role and his responsibility.
Yes, that worldly experience.
Yes, and the connections that they made, that he made there, the friends he made right in the Western world.
While reading Flight of the Bon Monks, I wondered if writing this book was akin to a pilgrimage for either of you.
Absolutely. Absolutely, in so many ways. Because we did physical pilgrimages of going to visit them, both His Holiness and Yongzhen Tenzin Namdok. Tenzin Namdok being the name in the book that we chose for him, and then His Holiness being Sanjay Tenzin in the book. And going the pilgrimages to go to see them and to visit them and to interview them, and then our physical pilgrimage to Tibet. and the monasteries that they established in exile, but also sort of a pilgrimage of knowledge. As we learned more and more and followed their story and checked it with sources of Tibetan history that accumulated. Harvey, what do we have, 50 or 60 books now on Tibetan history in our library?
Yeah, something like that.
So you could call it a journey, but because it was a story built on love, then I'm going to call it a pilgrimage. I think you're right.
Boy, how did you ever even get to a point where, okay, either the book is finished or the research is good, we can continue and perhaps wrap this up now? Was there a point where you felt that or realized that, Harvey? What did that look like or feel like?
Yeah, there wasn't an aha moment, but I think there was a moment. I think we got the story.
Yes, you did.
And we've been working on this for 10 years. I think it's probably time to pull the trigger on this and let's go see if we can find an agent.
I think the passing of His Holiness was sort of a landmark for us. At first, the book was going to be the story of how they got out, and it would sort of end at the border there. But then as we began to learn more about their experiences outside, and then the trip to London, and then coming back and establishing Dalanji and the Bumpo community in exile there in India, pretty much that sort of completed that story there. Yeah, the CIA was mixed up in all of that. So once we got sort of that, the basis done, and then after His Holiness died before we were able to declare the book done. So then we added the chapter in there on where we are now and what happened with His Holiness's passing and the appointment of the new His Holiness and so forth, which I think that sort of capped it off.
I agree. I'm glad to see that that piece was included in the book. This is a little off, but I couldn't help but think when reading about the monks who renounced their vows of nonviolence during all of this, and I don't know if that included the Bon or only the Tibetan Buddhists, but did you speak to anyone about this? It seems like such a huge thing to renounce nonviolence.
Yes, we interviewed Tempo Woser, who was one of the monks who renounced his vows. We had numerous interviews with him. He was the only surviving monk from that experience, but his memory was very good. He said he had to think about it, but he wanted to defend the abbot, and he knew the abbot needed to be defended. And there were something like several hundred monks there at the monastery, but all of them didn't go. And only a few of them renounced their vows, something like 20, 25, something like that. Most of them didn't want to go there. So it took some devotion to the abbot and some realization that he needed someone to defend him. And once he renounced his vows, he was not a monk ever again. Once he left Tibet, he became a farmer and he was married, and because monks are celibate as well.
Yes, yes.
But he got married and he had several children.
Now, where is Bon today? They survived and it seems to be on an upswing now too as well, even before your book is getting out there.
Well, it's a tiny little religion. Needless to say, it's tiny in terms of the numbers. But the monasteries in exile are... Well, all the monasteries in Tibetan tradition are pretty much schools. They're like universities here. And so you go to school, and once you graduate, then unless you stay in academia and teach or you stay in administration, you're expected to move on back out into the world. And so what happened is that once the community was founded in India and the basic needs were met of housing and food and a way to make a living, then they began to build the monastery there. And it turned into a school and began to train new geshes, which is like a PhD in philosophy, 12, 13 years of learning. As those geshes graduated, they began to go out into the world to try to make a living. And so Bun began to be able to have little seeds of it in places where these people went. Some came to the United States, Italy, Europe, Canada. And then from there, they became better at interacting with Western minds. And so then it became a little bit more popular and began to spread from there to Mexico, South America, Costa Rica, and so on and so forth. And so every year when they would graduate, or every other year graduate more Geshes, then there would be more people that would be going out into the world in order to make a living. Some of those people actually went back to Tibet in order to support the Bun communities in Tibet. And then also there were people that went to Nepal, over in the western part of Nepal in the Dolpo region, which had been Tibetan all along but was very poor and unable to really support much of a tradition there. So that's what's happened. It's really quite spread out all over the world, but it's still small. But it's there and growing because the Geshes are being graduated every year. And now nuns, they're doing the nunnery in India is now graduating women Geshes as well.
Harvey, do you have a closing comment you'd like to make? I know 30 minutes is a short time to cover so much that went on in the book and your process as a couple doing this. And is there something that hasn't been spoken about that you can share with us briefly?
I guess there's a lot that I could talk about, but in our process, I did the initial draft, and then Jackie would go over my draft, and then we would sit down and go through and together rewrite certain sections of it. So it was very cooperative, and Jackie's quite a good editor, and I did the initial writing, but without her, the book would not be as good as it is.
And Jackie, any final comment from you as far as either the process or something that affected you or something you learned?
Well, I'm just thrilled that people that are involved with the book were so gracious and helpful to us in the writing. They were generous with their stories, many of which were very difficult for them to tell because they drug up a lot of trauma for them. And so they were very generous to us in telling of their stories and of sharing their time and energy with us, which allowed us to write the book. It's been a journey for us both in terms of Harvey and I working together, great adventure, as well as learning for us to work together. But the main thing that I would say is that we wanted to write this book so that people, for a general audience, so people would learn about Bun and about the extraordinary people that were involved in this story. It was a great responsibility because they had given us their time and energy and stories for us to tell. So I'm very happy to have it be out there for people to read and enjoy, and I hope everybody likes it.
Yes, wonderful.
And I'd like to ask everyone, if we piqued their interest, to go to flightofthebonmonks.com.
Jackie Cole and Harvey Rice, who would have thought a couple from Galveston, Texas, would be embracing and able to share so much wonderful current history? Thank you. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And our podcasts are where you'd like to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.